Well, as I alluded to a little earlier, kickoff for the Ireland-New Zealand match at the Aviva Stadium this evening is at 7 o'clock. The last time, indeed the only time, our national team beat the All Blacks was that famous night in November 2016 in Soldier Field Stadium in Chicago. And that was the night the Irish team faced the New Zealand Haka with a figure eight in honour of the Munster head coach Anthony Foley, who had died just 3 weeks previously. Well, with me in studio today is Anthony's wife, Olive, and I'm also joined by Sister Helen Culhan, founder of Limerick's Children's Grief Centre, who recently won the inaugural National Lottery Good Causes of the Year Awards. And you are both more than welcome on the programme. I'll start with you, Olive, and I suppose it's 2 years on now. How are your boys doing?
Good morning, Marion.
Morning to you.
The boys are great, thank God. We've had a tough couple of years. But 2 years later, I must say that finally seen a little bit of light again. It was a turbulent couple of years.
Right. And very eventful in difficult ways as well as joyous ways. Because I was surprised to see a quote from you about a comparison between Anthony lifting the trophy for the Heineken Cup versus you going up to bring the gifts to the Pope.
Yeah. I did compare. We were very blessed to have been asked to bring up the gifts to the Pope when he was here in September. And, people asked, how did you get on? And I said, it was up there with when 2006 Munster winning the first European Cup final.
It was
that good, Mary.
Yeah, well, I thought you said it was better.
Maybe a little bit better, marginally. We better go there.
And how did the lads take going there? Was that an excitement for them?
Do you know, I was so impressed with how much they enjoyed it. I don't mind admitting that I had said to them the day before, download two movies, bring your iPads. It's going to be a long haul, lads. Because we were there from 10 o'clock in the morning, well, maybe even 9 o'clock in the morning until about 6 o'clock in the evening.
A long day.
It was a long day. But you know,
were you standing?
No, we were sitting. We were very lucky. We were sitting, but the children never took out their iPads, no movies. It was just that type of beautiful day where there was a lovely connection between everybody. We met everybody around us. We really had a wonderful day, a wonderful experience all around. And to be able to get that close to the Pope, and we were very lucky to have his blessing. We got his blessing when we got to stand in front of him.
So right. Well, that was rather nice. Because your faith and your church and religion is very important in your life.
Yeah, I have a deep faith and probably even strengthened over the last couple of years. But I do believe it has really helped me through. And I just feel very blessed that I'm guided by the Holy Spirit. And I'm very lucky.
Right. And I'm sitting beside you and I'm not ignoring you, Sister Helen. Was it another woman who helped you along the way? And did the commonality of faith matter, or would it not have mattered?
I don't think it would have mattered at all. In fact, it barely comes up in conversation when you meet Helen for the first few times. Myself and Helen have become quite close friends. So obviously we share our faith, and we did the rosary on the way up in the car, and I don't mind saying it. Now we talk about it all the time. But with regards, when she's dealing with children and all that, it's religion doesn't come into it at all.
Right. Yeah. The Anthony's death was utterly shocking for so many people. And from that documentary that was done, you could see how loved he was in Munster, and everybody was shocked. Clearly nobody more than you. Had you any indication coming up to that he was under stress? Well, he was under stress, there's no question about that. Any hint of ill health?
Absolutely nothing.
No?
Marian. Absolutely nothing. So the news was the most shocking thing imaginable. It was the last thing in the world I ever expected.
Yeah. And remind us of how you heard it.
Do you know, it was a regular Sunday morning. Not unusual that Granny popped up to the house and brought the children out for breakfast. And I went for a big long walk with my girlfriends. And because I was going for a walk, I'd left the phone in the car. And off we went. And when I got back into the car, I remember looking at my phone and all these missed calls. And I remember thinking to myself, what is wrong with people on a Sunday morning that I've all these missed calls? What are they doing? Ringing me, ringing. But as it happened, it was the missed calls were from Anthony's dad and they were from my mother and that had been trying to get hold of me. And it was terribly important that they got to tell me this news before I heard it on through the media or through the social medias, because they got hold of that information quite quickly. So it was my mother who arrived to my door when I got up home. It was my mother had to break the news to me, unfortunately. Not a nice job for anybody.
Not an enviable job, no. And I saw another quote from the man that told Anthony's father that he was dead in the bedroom.
Yeah, that was Nilo Donovan.
That's right,
Nilo. Yeah. Nilo unfortunately had to break the news to Brendan. We were lucky that Brendan was actually in Paris, so we felt we had that link to Anthony. Having Brendan over there just, I suppose, gave us a little bit of security.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So you had to make tracks to go straight over. Now, what did you think about doing about the children? They were 8 and 10. No, they were 7 and 9, was it?
I have to think about this, Marion. They were 8 and 11.
8 and 11, yeah. Right. Okay.
Do you know my instinct? Well, of course, that morning, I was greeted with such shock that morning. So I had gone into a state of shock. My instinct, Marion, would have been, let's protect the children now. We won't be doing, we'll hide them, nearly send them down to Granny's kind of attitude. We'll hide them away till this sorry affair is over. But on Sunday, I had to break the news to them. It was a very hectic day, very, very busy day.
Did you give a lot of thought to what you'd say to them?
I had about 2 minutes to get my thoughts together before I had to tell them. So no, I didn't. Now, the one thing I did was I knew that you have to say it very straight to children. So I didn't mention that he passed or we lost him. No, there was none of them. So I was able to use the word that Daddy died in his sleep. But it was the following morning that I rang David Coleman, is a neighbour of mine. He lives in Killaloe. I hope you don't mind me saying his name.
Oh, not at all.
David, I rang David the following morning. I said, David, just talk to me and tell me what I need to do here now. And, you know, he gave me the best advice. And he said, if you're going to Paris, bring the children to Paris. He said, let them spend as much time as you can with the children. So we were going to lay Anthony out at home and they spent the 2 full days with him at home, and it was lovely, and it was, and it's something that I'm so happy that I got the advice on, because definitely I wouldn't have exposed them that much to him at all, and it's such a lovely thing now that I have, that we have done that.
Yeah. I see Helen nodding away there, because everybody's inclination would be, don't upset the children, you know, or well, they're going to be upset, but as little as possible, let's mind them and send them up to Granny's.
And send them to Granny's. And the other thing is, tell them everything. You have to be so honest with them, because if you lose their trust, if you hide one thing from them, and what they, Helen actually always says this to me, what they will come up with in their head, if you haven't told them the truth, they're going to think it's far worse. Far worse things will pop into their heads. So I was completely honest and open with them from the very start. Thank God.
Yeah. And so you came home and you made a speech that was a eulogy that was incredibly moving. And I remember thinking at the time, where did you get the composure?
I'm not sure. I asked, I had spoken, my neighbour father, Pat, he was the chief celebrant at the funeral, and I had gone through it with him, you know, that morning, and I said, what do you think, Pat? And he said, do you know what? After communion, we'll sit down, think about it now, and if you feel, just stand up and go and say it if you feel it. So I just said, just Lord, please may help me make a good decision here. If this is, if I need to do this, let me just do it.
Yeah.
So, and do you know what? I do think I channeled my inner Anthony as well. And I stood up and I said, okay, there's going to be tears. This is not going to be pretty. I said, but I just ploughed through it. I just had it written down. I said, I'm just going to say it. It's written here. This is not difficult. I can do it. Yeah. I probably didn't realise the audience I had either. Marianne is another thing, because I just thought I was talking to friends and family in the church when it appeared in media. I was like, oh, jeepers, if I'd known that, I mightn't have.
Yeah, because, no, but it was beautifully done with the humour and all of that. But to hold yourself together must have been so difficult. Mm. When he was playing, and he was, as they say, the language, a legend, did you gather around everywhere with him?
I did, more or less, yeah. Yeah, there would have been very few matches that I probably would have missed. I would have gone to most of the matches, yeah.
Right, even with the children, I mean.
I dragged them to a good few matches as well. Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah, they loved it, yeah.
Yeah. And so when he would, just remind people of his achievements.
So he played, well, Shannon was his club. And played for Munster. I think he got something like 202 caps for Munster. And he played for Ireland. He got 62 caps from Ireland. And he captained Munster, Shannon Munster and Ireland.
Yeah.
His biggest achievement probably will, well, they won four in a row with Shannon that he would put. He'd rank very highly himself. And they won a good bit with Munster, but the Anthony's, I suppose, biggest one with Munster was in 2006, winning the European Cup final. That was huge for him. He captained Munster that day, and it was a real big day for
big us all. Event. Yeah, and they had been trying for years.
Yeah, we had two silver medals. Still looking at them at home. The box is closed.
Right, that's not what they were looking for. No. So, I mean, he was adored in Munster and respected, and in Ireland. Obviously as well, which must have been great for him, though it seems to me he wasn't that kind of a guy in some ways, but great for you and great for the two boys and great for the extended family.
Yeah, I mean, I think Anthony's a lovely gift of humility. That's my opinion. And he, I always say that, you know, Anthony was an idol to many without a shadow of a doubt, but it was home where he was idolised most, without a shadow.
Right.
The kids, very close to children, and they were his priority. We were number one, I'm afraid to say. Robbie came a close second, but he was a great family man.
Right. So when he was offered the role of coach, did he discuss it with you?
Do you know, that was always on Anthony's, it was always one of his goals was to coach Munster. Not that he would have gone around talking about this, you know, but I knew that he wanted to do that, and the opportunity came, and it's something that he embraced. And Marianne, I believe he gave it everything. He gave that job absolutely everything. Now, unfortunately, there were two very difficult years. Munster struggled, the team struggled, the players struggled. It was a very low time for everybody involved. But, you know, Anthony never lost heart. He never lost heart. And, you know, I think it says a lot that the year they had afterwards was absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
They achieved a lot and they played well. And you know what? They gave it. They were a fabulous bunch of players. And, you know, they grieved Anthony and they missed him terribly as well. Do you know what? I believe they did it for him. They just were able to muster something. And
yeah, because they won their next match.
Oh, they won the Glasgow. Yeah, that was a big team. And Glasgow were a good old rival. Do you know, it was it was a lovely match to win and a very special game. I watched it on television at home. My sister brought the children into it, and that was a fabulous day. Fabulous day for my children as well.
And were the children conscious of the bad publicity he was getting?
They were. Because, well, especially Tony was 11. You know, you can't hide anything from an 11-year-old. They're very clever. So
they can read.
They can read. And you know what? They hear it. They do. Yeah. So Dan was 8, probably not as affected. But yeah, they definitely would have struggled with that as well.
And did they articulate it?
Not particularly, no. But you'd know that they were struggling kids. Yeah,
really?
They found it, yeah, they found it hard.
Because presumably it was around the school and all that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found the school very supportive. I don't know. Do you know, it's hard to know where they will pick it up from. But, do you know, but you're right, they read. They can read the papers, yeah. And there was some pretty horrific stuff, yeah.
Well, I was looking through some of the headlines and there was some horrific stuff. Do you think tough bananas, you know, if you're playing, I was going to say senior hurling, but I mean, if you're playing in the top league, in the top pressure, in a game like rugby, that you just have to take it.
You do have to take it. And Anthony was able for it.
Yeah.
Where Anthony struggled was when we were struggling with it. Yeah. And you know what? I know I've quoted this line before, is Anthony would have always given me the same advice, Olive. I was never as bad as they said I was. And
yeah.
I was never as good as they said I was. So don't read anything. So just don't read it. Yeah.
So it must have been getting to him too.
It was, of course. Yeah, it was a stressful time.
Right. Mm. And the extended family, so his sister quoted as well, saying how hurtful some of these things were. I'm just thinking, you know, pundits go in and they think they have to do a job, and they do. Mm-hmm. But was it your husband I heard quoted saying they see the player but they don't see the person?
Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah, yeah. So true, actually, isn't it? Yeah. Mm.
And would you be cross with them over that?
Well, I'm certainly not cross now.
Right.
But I would have struggled with it, But no, I'm okay about it now. I'm able for it. I'd still find it hard when I see, but I even find it hard when I see, you know, even politicians even being criticised. My word, they're working. Everybody's working hard. Do you know, it's just so easy. The paper doesn't refuse ink, and it can be difficult sometimes, yeah.
Right, yeah. Now, how did you two meet up finally, so to speak?
Well, Anthony died on a Sunday, and on the Monday morning, the principal of the primary school where the children were, Killaloe Boys National School, Mr. Kieran Corcoran, he knew that he needed support. He said he hadn't had the experience of this level of bereavement in all his years of teaching.
Because so, Anthony had been so involved in sports and
well,
knew all the kids?
Well, that I suppose as well. And, do you know, it's a very small school. So he felt that, do you know, well, he needed really good guidance and support to know what to do with myself and the kids when we came back to school. But he also said that, do you know, the teachers needed, we needed to support the teachers, the kids, the friends in the classroom, the parents even, do you know, at the school gate. It was a huge shock to everybody. So he got in contact with Helen, I think on the Monday, and she offered great guidance to him. And when I brought the children back to school, I think it might have been about 2 weeks later, it was the first thing he said to me was, if you need help, I have somebody here that can really help you, and I highly recommend. She has been wonderful. And then roll on, Helen. And we've been glued at the hip since. Yeah.
And what made you trust her?
Well, Kieran's recommendation was wonderful, but at the minute I met her, I knew that, yeah, she's going to be able to help us, and I desperately needed help. I didn't know where to go at that stage. I knew that.
And what were you looking for?
I just needed to know what to do with the kids. Tell me what is right and what's wrong, what to do. And the kids needed support themselves, and that's exactly what we got.
And how do you work? So you've been sitting there patiently. How do you work with the kids? Because sometimes kids will just clam up, even you may find out ages later that something was really bothering them, but when you ask them, they say, no, what's wrong, nothing, you know, what's on your mind, don't know, all that kind of thing.
And I suppose, Marion, when I was setting up the Children's Grief Centre, I purposely set it up that it wasn't a counselling service. And my own background is that I'm a qualified social worker and play therapist, and life had taught me that children are unable to verbalise what they're feeling. And they usually act out because of their stage of development. So we purposely set up the service in that we would use mediums that children are used of. For example, like we have a particular workbook that we use for children where someone that they have loved has died. We have a workbook around separation because we work with a lot of children whose parents are separated. We use board games. We use clay. We use art. And children really like the idea that they're not coming for counselling, that this is a place of support. It's a free service. And the other thing that they actually like is confidential. So how we work, initially we meet with the parents. So I would have met with Olive on her own and you get the story. In the second session, and this is really very important, we meet with the parent and the child together, but we focus in on the child. Do you know why you're here? So there's no colluding and tell me about who died. And after about 10 minutes, then the parent goes to the waiting room and we introduce the workbook to the child and they have a look at that. And if they like it, we work through it. And then at the end of the session, the child has the option of inviting in the parent and sharing with the parent what's on their mind. And you will find initially children will say, because it is normal for children to protect their parents and parents to protect their children.
Yeah.
So children will say to me, oh, Helen, I don't want to upset mum. And maybe if I just recall a 14-year-old I worked with whose dad had died 2 years previously. And when she was finishing up, she said to me, what I liked about coming here, Helen, you were the first person who didn't cry when I mentioned dad. When I spoke to mom, she was crying. And when I spoke to Uncle Johnny, he was crying. So we give them that.
But is crying not part of a normal part of life?
It is. But we say when children are grieving, if they see mom or dad are falling around the place, they feel then we can't upset them.
Right. Yeah.
Because I'll always remember again, a 9-year-old and her mom had died when she was about 2. But her grief then started to come to the surface when she was 8 or 9, which is quite typical. And I remember she saying, as she coloured in a page, she said, Helen, when I come home from school, I always notice there's a tear in Granny's eyes. And Granny had lived in a granny flat near them.
Right.
So she felt she couldn't talk to anyone. And you see, when you're a child, that's what you think. So in our children's grief centre, and if so, why a child would, when a child would be colouring in and they'd get upset, I'd say, and would you like to paint your upset? Or would you like to go down to the clay? Or would you like to go to the sandpit? So the children then would get up and go to the next table. And like Marion, it is amazing when you see what they will paint. And you don't mind me giving another example.
Yeah.
An 8-year-old by that. And people find this very hard to believe. But see, children are very creative. And when they can't verbalise it, they will bring it out through the arts. And I remember this age.
And what if they're not artistic?
Well, then other children, then we might play a game of football.
All right, yeah.
Play a game of football.
OK. Sorry, I interrupted in the story about this. Yeah.
Or we have board games.
All right.
And so other children then will talk, Marion, will just simply talk and tell you, I have a pain here in my heart. So this little 8-year-old boy, and we were going through the workbook, and his dad had died when he was 6. And the question was, how do you feel when you think of dad? And he said, Helen, can I draw a heart? So Marion, he drew a heart and then he put a line in the middle. And then I'd say, tell me about your heart. And he said to me, Helen, I'm heartbroken. I'm heartbreaking. That's what he said. And then I said, what is it like to be heartbreaking? And he looked at me and he said, can I write it? So around his heart, Marion, he wrote, not alive, sad, guilty, upset, patience, angry. Then, so I'd say, wow, I'm making up a name now. Wow, Tom, you have worked really hard. Tell me about not alive. Now, this was an 8-year-old. And he said, Helen, when I feel sad, I feel not alive. Wasn't that just so, like, so profound? And so we talk about that. Upset, tell me about upset. Where do you feel the upset? And then he'd say, I feel it here in my heart. And how we work then, we say to the children, you know, even though our hearts are that size, they're very important. You'll always carry the memory of your dad in your heart forever.
And that released it for them? What benefits came to your boys?
Well, what I love about the way Helen and all the support team that she has, the way they deal with the children is you go in and you sit down. They sit one-on-one.
Yeah.
But then we're brought in, the parent is brought in for the last about 10 minutes. So inevitably, they will have spoken to Helen or whoever they're talking, whatever support staff team they're talking to. They'll have spoken about Dad and they'll have told little stories or something like that. And then Helen might say something like, you just tell Mum about that great story. Or she's able to actually unify the conversation so that now I'm talking about Dad to the children instead of, let's pretend now this didn't happen, don't mention Dad now because everybody's going to cry.
Yeah.
So she's able to open up the conversation so that for the last 10 minutes then that I'm now talking quite freely to the children about Dad and some lovely little story about something he did or the time we went here or the, that's where I felt that was huge help. And then we were able to continue the conversation on the way home in the car. And next thing we're talking about Dad from morning till night because he comes up in conversation constantly. And, you know, I think Helen gives them the tools to interpret what's happened and gives them an ear for to listen to and so they can be heard. So I just think
kind of questions do they ask about him? Do they ask about what happened to him or do they ask about his glory days or do they ask, what do they ask about?
All of them things, yeah. They love it and they love, tell us something before we were born, tell us something. But you know, I've been very blessed that Anthony had actually written a book. He had written it the year Peter O'Reilly was a writer. He'd written that in 2008, the year that Dan was born.
Right.
And it really documented so much, every match. And we and Helen always says that this is something that I'm very privileged to have. You know, other kids may have to make a memory book to try and come up with these little stories and write them out. And we have it. And, you know, in the beginning, what we used to do, we'd go to bed early at night, we'd say our prayers, and then I'd read a few pages of Dad's book. And their eyes would be wide open. They'd really enjoy this. And then inevitably they'd have some questions and tell us about that player, Mum. Is that guy? I remember meeting him or, you know, and they just love it. So we have this really, really important thing in our home that just has everything about their lives documented. You know what? About myself and Anthony, when, you know, we met before we had kids, before we got married and all that. And they're fascinated. They just love all of that information.
So is it true that his sister was the matchmaker?
I went to school with Anthony's sister. We were in the presentation. We were boarders in the presentation, a convent in Thurles. And so we carpooled. So there was always a nudge and a wink. There's Anthony. Now, Anthony was this huge, I was this tiny little thing. And Anthony was this enormous rugby player. I thought he was so terrifying and intimidating. It was a few years later now, yes. But Orla would have definitely instigated that, yeah. Yeah.
She set her eye on you. It's the fella that's supposed to set.
That's so funny, yeah. Oh, they matched us up well, yeah.
And so presumably that would all be of interest to the kids.
They love that. They absolutely love that, yeah.
What in the name of God would somebody do in your circumstances if you weren't interested in rugby?
Well, I may have a confession to make here now on the radio. I'm not really that into rugby. I struggle with it now. And people say, do you remember that match when they beat blah, blah, blah 5 years ago? I'm going, yeah, nodding blankly. Yeah, I do remember nothing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it wouldn't be your scene?
Not at all, no.
So did he ever talk to you about rugby?
I'm sure I was going to all the rugby matches. Do you know, I was there, I was present, but a bit vacant maybe some of the time.
Vacant.
Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah.
And was there great crack associated with
it? Well, I said to Helen coming up, I said, This reminds me, coming up here to Dublin today, it's International Day. Yeah. I had so much fun. I said I was wagged within an inch of my life coming up here dressed to the nines and going to the matches. We had so much fun. We had really had so much fun with the girls and pre-match luncheons in the Berkeley Court and then down to Lansdowne Road, the old Lansdowne Road, yeah, as we knew it. And then dinners in the Shelburne. I mean, it was really a beautiful time, really the most beautiful memories made around them times.
Right.
And of course, Ireland did very well there. We had a great run as well, and we were, as they are now, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was great that we were winning as well. It was lovely.
When was that? When did we have that great run?
I hear now. What did I say? do you know, I mean, the Six Nations. Yeah, we did a good few great runs of Six Nations.
Okay. I saw another wag of another rugby player who hadn't a clue either.
Oh, so I love it. I bet you she's my mate.
So, like, given tonight, or, you know, what's going to happen this evening, and you'd have been at the dinner, I presume, last night. Or would that be men only if they have the dinner the night before?
That would be men only, yeah. No, we've right, always travelled up on the morning of the internationals.
Oh, right.
To the Berkeley Court, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that's that. And, like, it's kind of very poignant in a way, because tell us about the match in Chicago. That was only 3 weeks after he died.
Yeah, we were still very much in shock at that stage. I went down that day to my friend's house. A few of us gathered in my friend's house and we all watched it together. It was, so we were sitting down and we were watching the Haka, and next thing, it took a few minutes for the penny to drop to go, what are the Irish players doing? Oh my word, they're in a figure of eight. And I mean, that's very clever. And then we saw that the Munster players were at the front of it. And I went, my word, Anthony is very present over in Soldier Field today. I said, this is going to be really good. Now, when they won, that was such an incredible moment for me and the children. That was so, so special.
Right.
Yeah, Anthony, and I love this. I love this. That somebody told me afterwards that, you know, the score, which was 29-40,
and it was reversed.
So the last time Anthony played against the All Blacks was 2001, and they lost 29-40. And to think that they won 29-40, that number eight, that's a huge, that's yeah, really important to me. I love that. I really cherish that.
Right. Yeah. And them all wearing eight on their jerseys as well.
Mm.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, right, there was a terrorising, unintentionally, New Zealand player who was close, well, Anthony and himself.
Jonah Lomu.
Yes.
Oh, listen, Jonah Lomu holds a very warm place in our hearts. Anthony travelled to New Zealand in 1992 with the Irish schoolboys. They were a fabulous bunch of guys. They're still very unified, great friends today, and they're really supportive, and I have a lot of contact with them, and they're really wonderful. But they played New Zealand, and Jonah Lomu came up against them. This is Irish schoolboy. So Jonah Lomu was marking Anthony. They were both playing number six at the time. I've really done my homework here.
Yeah.
And after the match, they swapped jerseys. So this became really, really precious to us. Sadly, you know, Jonah Lomu died 3 years ago tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 3 years ago. This weekend, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
We were very sad that time. It was a real shock to us. And because Anthony played against him after that at international level as well. So we had Jonah Lomu's jersey at home. We'd take it out every now and then and go, God, is that very cool? We've Jonah Lomu's jersey. And we'd put it back into the box. But the last Christmas present that I bought Anthony, which was 3 years ago, I took out the jersey and I got it framed. And that was his gift. So we have Jonah Lomu's jersey hanging in our house.
Right.
So it's ironic to think that the two of them are gone.
Yeah, and the two of them so young.
I know. It's hard to believe sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
two great, great men.
Right. Mm. Well, you were talking about that as a prezi. man, you're not supposed to have sympathy for, because they're supposed to really enjoy it. But I always think of people like Johnny Sexton and Ronan O'Gara in his time, and the stress of what they have to do and the pressure on them. He sent a very nice gift to your son. Tell us that story.
Oh, I love this. God, you're really catching me with all the details of matches and stuff. But Ireland...
Never mind about six, the details. Six
nations,
yeah.
Six nations last year. And Johnny kicked the drop goal, or was it the penalty, to win that match, which we won that Six Nations. And really, that was such a huge, huge kick that he got that. And that jersey,
memorable, yes.
Very, very memorable, yeah. And wonderful. And afterwards, he wrote to me the following week, and he sent down the jersey, and it arrived actually on Dan's birthday. So Dan always said, we said, sure, listen, it must be Dan's birthday present. It's very exciting. We opened up that parcel and saw that jersey. Well, there was tears of joy in our house, and they argued then who's bringing it into school first.
Right.
It's going to be the big thing. But
it was a very kind and thoughtful thing to do, wasn't
it? He said he was in Paris that weekend, and he said when he was in Paris, Johnny and Anthony were unlikely friends, but they were good. They had a lovely little relationship. Anthony used to slag him all the time. When are you coming back down to play for your real province? Because there's Limerick connections there.
Yeah.
So Johnny said that he had a special weekend. He thought about Anthony, and he died in Paris, and he thought about Anthony so much. And he said, yeah, he said, this is the thing to do. I'm sending it down to Olive and the kids, and we treasure that jersey.
I just thought it was a very thoughtful thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. As Paul O'Connell said, that's Johnny, pure class.
Well, there you go. Well, your own son has a touch of class about him as well. Tell me about the eight for eight.
I'm delighted you've asked me this, because I feel so self-indulgent by telling the story, because I'm very proud of him. This all came about after the Glasgow game. So it was 8 days after Anthony died. And we were sitting at home, and my friend Emer said to Tony, well, Tony, I don't go to Mass, but I'm going to go to Mass for the next 8 Sundays, because there's 8 Sundays between here and Christmas, because your dad was a great number 8. And I thought, God, isn't that lovely? Paid no more heed to it, and that was the end of it as far as I was concerned. But Tony went off and did a lovely PowerPoint presentation, or put all this and hashtag 8 Masses for number 8. He came up with all of this on his own, and he made a Facebook page. He's an 11-year-old now, dying to.
I'm highly impressed.
I know, I wouldn't have a clue. So he came up with this beautiful idea, and I said, God, isn't that gorgeous? But I rang a friend of mine now who's handy at this sort of thing, Eugene Hogan, and I said, Eugene, would you pop up tomorrow? Tony has this lovely thing done. Tell me what you think, and should we send it out as a, you know, make a Facebook page and, yes, and send it out. Eugene thought it was fabulous and so moving. And you know what? We did it. And you know that reached 160,000 people.
Wow.
And over something like 50 countries. And the amount of post that came to us and the messages for Tony thanking him for the letters were, I haven't been to Mass for years. I've started going to Mass. Now it's the highlight of my week. I have come back to God. I've realised the beauty of this. And there's another really nice story that I'll tell really quickly.
It's okay.
It is... I won't mention any names now.
This pair are tic-tacking. So, but anyway, so carry on.
Let's just say, I'm going to say a bishop, we won't mention any names, has a really good friend. And this friend never went to Mass. So, and he met his friend, the bishop said, well, what did you, well, I was actually at Mass on Sunday. He said, well, what are you doing at Mass? Was there a funeral or something on? And he said, Bishop, if a child asks you to go to Mass, you go to Mass. And the bishop's there going, I'm your friend and I'm the bishop and you won't go to Mass. I thought it was great. I really loved that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, listen, I want to give you some of the calls that are coming in. Anthony's wife, Olive, is just as much an inspiration, excuse me, as he himself. She's truly the leader of a resurgence of faith and hope, so very much needed in our country right now. And that comes from Hugh. Another one says, Marion, how good to hear Olive and how she handled her children after their father's death. My father died when I was 7, many years ago. No one ever told me. I was sent to relatives but brought to the funeral mass, not knowing who was dead. This has stayed with me all my life. For years, I never mentioned his name. Thank God things have changed. Is that common enough? Well,
Marion, that's very common, and I'm delighted that has come in, because even in 2018, we have parents who will not bring children to their grandparents' funerals. And they're wondering then, what is the problem? And I read a most beautiful article. I was interviewed by Sean O'Rourke in February, and Daniel McConnell wrote a most profound piece. And he said, after listening to my interview with Anne Comerford, one of our board of management members, yeah, it touched into the death of his own mother when he was 12 years old. And we have this up at work. Every child has a right to be heard. And what Daniel was saying in that article, which I absolutely, he is so profound, every parent should read it, was that if children, and exactly what that, and I think that's why our centre in Limerick, I suppose, has been so successful, because we are giving children the opportunity to voice. And you see, Marion, if they don't get that opportunity, exactly as that person has stated, they will carry it with them through life. And like, I would have worked in a hospice, Marion, for 8 years.
Yeah.
And children would say to me, Helen, when there'd be no one around, I know my mummy is very sick, but no one will talk to me. And I feel so angry.
Yeah.
You know, we treat children like that they're fools. And if we don't deal with their emotions at that stage, it will go on. And later on, they'll be depressed, carry it through, have different problems.
Right. Okay. Delighted to hear Olive is doing well again. Terrible ordeal for herself and the lads. Now, just before we finish up, that whole funeral and bringing home of the body, and Ronan O'Gara had arranged something in the church in the airport, that must have been emotionally exhausting.
It was. God, that whole day. We flew to Paris the Wednesday morning. He died on Sunday, yeah. It was Wednesday morning we flew to Paris. Ronan had been in Paris and he had been amazing. He did everything. So he had organised the most beautiful service. And you know what? He knew. He said, Olive will want this. Olive will like this. And he just knew. And myself and Raj go back a long way and we'd have very similar values, and he'd have a very deep faith as well, which is lovely. And we had the most beautiful prayers and a beautiful little service. And I felt that I loved that now. It's a real treasured time at the of the whole funeral. So, and then coming home, bringing Anthony home was very special and really helped by Rog, I must say, yeah.
Right. And as you said, very amusingly, you know, he'd have hated it, but you loved it.
He would have absolutely like the fuss. Hated the fuss.
Yeah. But it was an amazing turnout. But and was there, because you seem a very nice and decent person, was there a bit of you saying, well, here they all are now talking about him as if he was a saint, and a week ago they were giving out stink about him?
Well, do you know what I mean? That's life, isn't it? And it's okay.
Is that a yes?
It is. Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, listen, we'll take a break and we're bringing somebody else in the commercial break. So back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Now we have been joined in studio by Eddie O'Sullivan, who's the working man today, I presume, given the big event that's coming up. Eddie, you go back with Anthony, otherwise known as Axel.
Yeah, I was coached to Ireland when Anthony was involved quite a bit. I started out initially as assistant coach when Anthony came back. He got capped early in his career, and it was a kind of a turbulent time in the '90s in Irish rugby, very up and down, and he fell out of favour. And I remember I came back from America in 99, came in as assistant coach, and he was in really good form for Munster, and I remember pushing really hard to get him back in. His football ability, his knowledge of the game, his rugby brain was fantastic, which was one of the reasons he went into coaching after. It was an obvious step for him. But he had a good run right through there, right up until, I think, his last tour was 2006 in Australia and New Zealand. So I saw a lot of him over that time, yeah.
And, right.
Had a good time, yeah. I love working with him because, for me, as I said, he had a rugby brain. So as a coach, you could connect them very easily. He understood. Like, some players play and they just play really well. They're talented, they've got ability, they're fast, they're strong. But Anthony had a rugby brain, which is a little bit different. He understood the game. And I think that came from...
His father, was
yes,
it?
Yes, I was going to say that. Growing up with his dad and Keith Wood in Killaloe. And I know Woody told me stories of Anthony and his dad, Brendan, who I actually played against and with. And I played with Munster, with Brendan. He was coming.
Who also was capped for Ireland?
Yes,
wasn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I just mentioned that I was at the beginning of my career, and then Brendan was at the end of his career.
Right.
Just
to
get that in. but I played with Brendan. I played against him for Gary Owen. I played with Gary Owen. He was with Shannon. We had great battles in Thomond Park back in the day when rugby was amateur. I remember Keith Wood telling me that, you know, during the summer, Anthony and his dad would be sitting in front of the television watching rugby videos and analysing them. You know, going back over them and the old rewind the tapes and the VHS tapes. And Woody said, like, the weather would be fantastic. I said, but they'd be so engrossed and going back over. And there might be a Lions tour on and they'd be going back hashing every move. So I think that was, like, that's where
that
his rugby brain.
That gives you an analysis.
Oh, yeah. He had extraordinary rugby brain. So for me, he was always going to be a coach. And for that reason, was when I coached him, I was involved with him. You just told him something and you could see he got it straight away. And you could relax because when he's on the field, he was going to carry that out. You know, you tell guys sometimes and you're not sure they got it.
Yeah.
And you only find out when they didn't get it.
Yeah.
But he had that kind of innate ability on
or
the field.
Or in the heat of battle, so to
speak. Yeah, absolutely. A great rugby brain.
Yeah. I know you do a bit of punditry, but you took a bit of punishment in the press too in the past. How do you cope with that?
Well, I personally, I'm okay with it. I used to always worry about my family, you know, because I had young kids at the time, during their teens.
That's what you were saying too, Olive.
And I think it's a very simple line, Marion. I'm a pundit at the moment. And, you know, as a pundit, you have to give credit and you have to be critical. But I have always focused on what's on the field, like a bad tactical decision or a bad error on the field, a bad selection. That's okay. But never, ever morph into personal attacks. And that's the big difference.
Or saying, well, you have to get rid of this guy.
Well, that's okay too, in a sense that, look, it's a job, and if it's going well, you keep it, coach, and if it's not going well, you probably lose it. And very few coaches leave on their own terms. That's just the way of sport. But I think on the day-to-day basis of analysing rugby, analyse what happened on the field, or analyse tactics, or analyse personal performances in terms of rugby, but never criticise people personally, never make it personal. That's the thing for me that I find upsetting, is that at some point it turns on the person.
And yeah, I think if that's you wrong. Take what happened in soccer now last week, and you would have had the experience of booing in Thomond Park, which is kind of unheard of in one sense and very hurtful. And then there was booing last week at the soccer.
That to me is it's sad because, you know, the supports are airing their grievances, but, like, some of the criticism around players and coaches becomes personal. Like, that it's about them as people. They're bad people. I mean, I was compared to Hitler at one stage and Stalin on another day, you know, which I thought my kids were.
Which was worse?
I'm not sure, but none of them were good, you know.
Right.
But I mean,
no,
it's kind of throwaway remark, but my kids were in their teens and they were in school and they got a bit of bullying in school because I was a fair target, so they were a fair target. So I always worry about that. People, I don't think people say those things that they want that to happen, but there are unintended consequences of criticising people personally.
Right.
And you stick around the tactics and around the decisions on the field and the selections, and that's all fair game.
I saw a quote from Anthony saying, you know, about rugby, you know, talk about the rugby, the player, the play, but remember it's also a person.
Exactly.
And I think that can get forgotten.
Mm. Yeah. Wasn't there something about Tyler, when Tyler came to Munster, he was really getting out. He had very hit badly with injuries.
Yeah.
And the press were like, well, get rid of him. He's injured, injured. He said, he's not a piece of meat. He's a person, and we will help him to recover from injuries. And we have brought him here, and he is a monster man. I thought it was such a lovely, and that's the way Anthony would have always
said. It's a soccer mentality, Marion, I think, that's split into rugby, which is unfortunate about the game going professional, but there is an element of that. And you're seeing how they treat players and coaches, that they're dispensable very suddenly, you know, and that's sad because there are people behind it.
Right. Just very quickly, because I'm watching the clock, and I know you'll appreciate this, because I have to stop for the Angelus. So before I do, can I just ask you, your ambassador for the Children's Grief Centre, we'll put that up. That's giving you great satisfaction.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. And we have a big project coming up at the moment now because we need a new premises. So we'll be launching that in the new year.
Okay. And congratulations on the lottery award.
Thank you,
Maria. And enjoy the money and spend it well.
Thank you very much.
I am now a little bit over time and we will pause for the Angelus.